Hello and welcome to Rock and Roll Politics, the podcast with me, Steve Richards. Thanks so much for tuning in wherever you are. This for new listeners, and there are many. This is the podcast where we make sense of the crazy world of British politics, put what appears to be random madness into some kind of context, and leave each podcast in our time together thinking, we got it all sorted. And today really is a vivid example of that. So what we're going to do in our time together, if it's okay with all of you, I'm going to reflect on a very important element of British politics, and that's the battle of ideas. And talking about context, we're going to go back a bit in terms of the battle of ideas and then look at how Rachel Reeves' May's lecture fits into that and the wider Labour pitch. So that's what we're going to do. Then we're going to have some brilliant questions. Some of you will be listening to this after the live show at King's Place on Tuesday night. Some of you before. If before, there are just a few tickets left in the very posh balcony of the main concert hall. So do come along, or buy the stream ticket. So you can sit there with a glass of wine and kind of just make sense. You can also join in with all the unreliable predictions and questions and everything. So there's those options. If you're listening to it afterwards, thanks for coming along. And there will be more on that in the next podcast. So, yeah, the battle of ideas in the context of Rachel Reeves' May's lecture and some other things going on in the Labour Party. I was very struck long ago by a speech made by Nigel Lawson. He made it in 1991. He was on the back benches by then, having been, of course, that radical chancellor still cited today by Sunak and others as one of their heroes. And on the back benches, he made an observation which kind of chimed with me at the time. Labour were well ahead in the polls in 1991, and certainly when he made this speech, though incidentally nowhere near as far ahead as they are now. But Lawson's predicted very confidently that the Tories would win the next election because they were winning still the battle of ideas. And what he meant by that was the orthodoxies that in many ways he kind of personified, beginning actually with his May's lecture, which is often seen as the model of a lecture which had ideas that were to be implemented in the, after they then went on to win a landslide in 87, and he was still Chancellor and, of course, did his famous tax cuts, etc., in subsequent budgets. And he was arguing that the ideas around that period were still very much dominant, that Neil Kinnock and his deputy leader, Roy Hattersley, had tried to put forward an alternative idea about the enabling state and the state being the agent of freedom. Roy Hattersley, I've mentioned this before on the podcast, wrote a book, a brilliant book actually, called Choose Freedom, trying to seize the term freedom from Margaret Thatcher and make it a Labour idea. But it didn't resonate. The cheerleaders in the newspapers were still very Thatcherite, even though by 1991, when Lawson made the speech, Thatcher had been the subject of the dramatic regicide in 1990. But he was right. In the battle of ideas, there were still orthodoxies and assumptions that tax cuts were an act of benevolence that grew the economy, that public spending was often a waste of money, and that Britain's services could be transformed by that magic word reform, although it hadn't become quite as ubiquitous, that imprecise term, as it was to be later on. And however hard Neil Kinnock and others pressed, they couldn't get through, even though they were way ahead in the opinion polls. And the Lawson was vindicated in one sense when, in the build-up to the 1992 election, famously John Smith held his alternative budget, which proposed some tax rises along with tax cuts for many people, but it became the tax bombshell and Labour lost. And what is so important, I think, in that sequence is the recognition from Lawson, who, like Thatcher, they fell out famously, but in some ways there were similarities. I mean, he was much more forensic and precise and calm compared with her, a sort of impulsive radicalism. But they both shared this sense that ideas mattered and you had to win arguments. Her fascination with politics, actually, was much less to do with kind of factionalism and intrigue. It was she loved arguments. In the 70s, when she was leader of the opposition, she used to go over to the United States to take part in various programs there, which were in effect debates. And she would put the case for freedom and therefore the need for inequality, because without inequality, you don't get freedom, etc. She would put those arguments really just for the pleasure of taking part in a battle of ideas, because those programs, it was before the era of YouTube and all the rest of it, so they weren't seen widely in Britain, although it began to establish her reputation in the United States on the radical right. And Lawson was the same. He knew that although she was a populist, she could then turn it all into language about you can't spend more as a government than you earn, like my father as a grocer couldn't spend more than he earned in his grocer's shop. It was nonsense, but it was a sort of accessible nonsense. Lawson wasn't like that and was not used much in election campaigns. But he did know that ideas mattered, and you needed to win the battle of ideas to make sense of the policies that arose from them. And what I found so fascinating when listening to Rachel Reeves May's lecture was how unusual and in a way fresh it felt to hear someone putting a sort of much wider case about why she was behaving in the way she was. I mean, in politics, not anything else. And contextualizing the basis on which she would be making her pitch as shadow chancellor. The rarity itself felt novel. If you think of other Labour figures in this era, including, of course, Keir Starmer, he has not really been interested in, it seems, or engaged with a battle of ideas. He does reference the past a bit, but it's more kind of sweeping than Reeves' arguments the other day. He talks about the disaster of the last 14 years, but doesn't really go into detail as to what those disasters were, why they arose from a set of beliefs on the right, and then combined with a belief in British exceptionalism, etc. And that therefore he, having analysed that, was going to lead to a counter. He certainly doesn't really go back to the 70s, 80s, 90s in the way that Rachel Reeves did, beyond saying, in a very sweeping way, that the challenge he will face if he becomes Prime Minister almost combines 45, 64 and 97, the other times when a Labour leader became Prime Minister from opposition, although actually wasn't really from opposition. He had been Deputy Prime Minister in the war coalition. But that's more or less it. With Keir Starmer, you get, say, sometimes a speech about an agenda, his five missions, and so on, but not really an analysis of why Toryism in its recent manifestations, Cameron, Osborne, then obviously the Brexit sequence, and then Truss and Sunak, have failed, and why their beliefs and ideas formed the failure. And Reeves did that and did it very effectively. Before we get to that, one problem with this endless referencing of Margaret Thatcher by those briefing Rachel Reeves' speech in advance, by those briefing for Keir Starmer and others. There's been a lot of Labour referencing to Margaret Thatcher in recent days. You know, I know why they're doing it. They think it reassures Tory voters that they can switch to Labour, those Tory voters who continue to revere Thatcher, and crucially, the Tory newspapers. So they got a couple of front page splashes in the Daily Telegraph about Rachel Reeves kind of channeling her inner Thatcher, and, you know, they'd have been thrilled. But, oh, yeah, Telegraph readers will think, yeah, they can vote Labour now. I don't think that thought process happens, actually. And, of course, the Telegraph will not be endorsing Labour. But there is a big problem with it. And the problem can be seen by comparing what Thatcher did with this endless referencing to Thatcher now. Thatcher never, when building up to 1979, briefed or stated that she was channeling her inner Harold Macmillan, or, to make it symmetrical, her inner Harold Wilson, who had been, of course, a landslide election winner in his time, and Macmillan won triumphantly in a general election, which kind of led to a huge sense of angst in the Labour Party when he succeeded Eden after the Suez crisis. She never did anything like that. Indeed, by implication, although only by implication, she was distancing herself from the party's past and projecting herself as the figure for the future in a distinct way, rejecting the corporatism of the 60s and 70s that had led to a crisis which raised questions about who governs Britain and all the rest of it. And so by referencing Thatcher so often, the Labour leadership is already not behaving like her, because she would not reference figures from the past. By doing so also, they limit the space available to them to challenge some of the things that she did, because if you appear to be endorsing her, that does inevitably narrow the space available in the battle of ideas to challenge her ideas. Now, this creates a mess for Labour. When Keir Starmer did a piece for the Sunday Telegraph where he praised Thatcher for releasing Britain's entrepreneurial spirit or whatever, it was briefed, you know, Starmer praises Thatcher, you know, and it caused him problems. I don't think it helped him in any way at all. He was up in Scotland at a gala dinner a few days later, and he was asked about it. And, you know, he was told quite explicitly, she said, she's hated in much of Scotland. And Starmer said, well, I don't like her either. I opposed what she stood for in every way. And Rachel Reeves, since the May's lecture, has been interviewed. Oh, so you're a great admirer of Thatcher. And she said, I joined the Labour Party because I opposed her policies so much. They really need to stop referencing figures from the past. Quite often, Starmer's team have briefed that he was embracing Tony Blair in some of his speeches. And the cue on the Today programme news bulletins before some of his keynote speeches have referenced Blair as much as Starmer. Now, Thatcher wouldn't have referenced Heath, far from it. She was distancing herself from him. And as I said, neither would she have referenced any previous prime minister. It shows an insecurity about where the Labour Party stands in the battle of ideas when a figure is referenced who you actually oppose. And they should stop doing it. And I kind of spoke to quite a few people who went to the May's lecture, you know, serious economists, who were impressed with the talk, but despaired of these juvenile, clunky briefings that seem much cleverer than they are. And indeed, I've had emails from some of you in the Rock and Roll Politics Cooperative making that very point about Scotland. and make it harder for Scottish Labour to put a case when it's sort of all this stuff comes back. Oh, Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves are great admirers of Margaret Thatcher, which when they're not. That said, they do have a point, and this point should be made again and again and again. The challenges this government faces, if it wins the election, however big the majority, are as great as 79, and in some ways greater. And of course, that, when you hear the speeches and the stuff, the interviews, that's what they all say. And that's a fair point, to compare the scale of the challenge with 79. And in some ways, in my view, and indeed their view, it's greater. But that's it. And then you move on to how this has come about and what you intend to do about it. And in a lecture like the Mays lecture, it is more on the level of ideas rather than detailed policy. Some people said afterwards, oh, there was no new policies. It's not the place for it. And say the Lawson lecture is a model of sorts, but so was Rachel Reeves. And you just don't hear very often in this kind of neurotic attempt to link the Starmer project with the Blair project and New Labour, an analysis which includes an analysis of where New Labour went wrong. In terms of the battle of ideas, what I think in essence she was doing was trying to legitimise a role for the state, an active state, as she calls it. She, Rachel Reeves, describes herself and is, I think, a social democrat. And therefore, you recognise the importance of the state as an instrument for change. Now, that does not mean, she made clear, a bigger state necessarily. Although I think over time, that will have to be part of the solution to the crisis that has arisen, as she so forensically and effectively described, you know, the failures. It was the irony was, it was a brilliant refutation of the Thatcher-Lawson project of the 80s. And then the Cameron-Osborne austerity period she challenged and went out of her way, incidentally and importantly, to make a point. It seems to me two points have been airbrushed out of an analysis of Tory rule. She didn't mention this, but in the 80s, Thatcher had North Sea oil pouring out. She was a lucky prime minister. Now, the Norwegian government used the proceeds very effectively. She much more short-termist in her use of that money, but there it was, pumping out. And it's never referred to. When she died, The World at One did 40 minutes on Margaret Thatcher. No reference to the fact that in the 80s, they had the North Sea oil revenues coming into their coffers. But the thing she did reference, which is not mentioned very often, that Cameron and Osborne in 2010 had the joy of just wackily low interest rates to borrow, for governments to borrow. Bit more for individuals, but for governments, it was gloriously cheap to borrow and to borrow for capital spending. They didn't borrow, they did the opposite. They cut capital spending. And it was a huge mistake, one of many. And she highlighted it. It's quite popular on the sort of Blairite wing of New Labour to say, yeah, well, Cameron and Osborne, it was pretty sensible what they did. You know, they were like us in many ways. And indeed, I sometimes think, you know, people like my old friend John Rentel, who writes for The Independent, still kind of really sees Blair and Cameron as one, and that anyone a millimetre to the left of Cameron is a kind of, you know, dangerous Marxist in their eyes. But anyway, she exposed the weaknesses that have led to this situation. And then, of course, comes to the present, which is trickier for a Labour shadow chancellor. For lots of reasons. The markets are suspicious, the media is based on the right, and the right-wing newspapers frame the way the BBC see Labour. So, you know, if to give an example, actually, you know, the cuts in national insurance that Jeremy Hunt announced and other things, they've cut it. No real questions asked about where the money's coming from. If Labour announced they were to spend 10p to fund an ice cream for one pupil in a primary school in East Grinstead, all hell would break loose. Where's it coming from? Will it leave a black hole in 2032? Will it mean tax rises to pay for the ice cream? And every interview with Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer will be framed along the same lines. It's bonkers. But given that that's the case, it's very hard to talk about public spending increases without it being reported as a threat rather than part of a solution to the dire public services, the low productivity, etc. But I think in recognizing and putting the case for a nimble, active state, working with others, business and all and other agencies, there is an idea there that needs developing, but it's important. And it's in comparison with an assumption that a small, inactive state is the best way to deliver growth, wealth, and therefore better public services, perhaps through the private sector delivering them on a greater scale than the state, closer, in other words, to the United States. This is a kind of right-wing view. And I think she was challenging that. And she, incidentally, for those in the cooperative, including Dominica, our correspondent in France, who says politicians never mention Brexit, she did. And she acknowledged that many specialists see that the deal negotiated by Johnson and Lord Frosty Frost, the comedy double act that has kind of wrecked Britain in many ways, not the only reason why Britain is in a dire state, but it's a fundamental one. She acknowledged that it's not 5% off GDP. You know, the Tories pretend that this is not the case when it clearly is. And so she did reference that. Now, what Labour do about that is still not entirely clear, though I know a lot of work is going on behind the scenes on that front. So I thought it was a very effective contextualising, which you have to do if you're going to win a battle of ideas. And I think in the end, the ideas, although of course framed in this pre-election period, gave some hope of an approach that won't wholly mimic New Labour that was formed and governed in a very different era to this one. Some of her pre-election thinking is heavily influenced by Gordon Brown's approach in the build-up to 1997, and I know she speaks to him quite a lot, and she spoke to Alistair Darling quite a lot when he was alive. So Gordon Brown, in the first conversation he had with Rachel Reeves when she became Shadow Chancellor, said, "You cannot utter a word about spending without saying how you're going to pay for it." And so hence these tiny incremental propositions, which are paid for by tiny tax rises that in the great scheme of things are pretty meaningless. But that's what New Labour did, and that's what she is trying to do. But in the broader framing of an argument, I think she moved on from pre-97, and as others have observed, she was quite critical of elements of the New Labour project, which is interesting when there are quite a few in the Keir Starmer operation who revere that period. And Keir Starmer, in turning to the winners and in his aching to win, leading a party that usually loses, has to some extent turned into a devotee too. Now, Nigel Lawson, in that speech, "The party that wins the battle of ideas wins elections."
and I can see the embryonic sense of an idea in the Reeves speech, which you can't really see in some of the other speeches made recently. I think Bridget Phillipson tries to make the argument about freedom. In Nick Thomas Simmons, they've got a historian who has the power to contextualize and make sense of things by referencing back, and it is a power, and he's got it. But on the whole, this battle of ideas has been not really contested heavily. It's, you know, technocratic exchanges of policy ideas, but not a battle of ideas. Lawson, the party that wins the battle of ideas wins elections. And of course, the Tories went on to win the 1992 election. And now, over to your brilliant questions. So just give me a second while I get all the questions up. There've been a lot of them. Oh, yeah, before we start, I want to thank the legendary Canon Paul Arbuthnot, who has kept us very informed with events in Ireland. He alerted me to the departure of Varadkar almost before it happened. So thank you, Paul, accompanied by, as ever, brilliant analysis. Jeff Strange also gave some analysis of Sinn Féin and its impact in Ireland and what that might mean. So thank you all for kind of keeping us all informed of really dramatic developments in Irish politics. And I'm going to follow incredibly closely. You can find yourself being sucked up by British politics or American politics, but we in the cooperative need to leave the space open to follow what's happening in Ireland and, of course, many other places, France, Germany. Politics is always interesting, but we're living through an interesting, kind of very interesting phase at the moment, alarming in some respects, but not all. Now, just the very point, I'll read Andrew Anderson from Edinburgh. Andrew and everyone else. The tickets for the Rock and Roll Politics shows in Edinburgh, different show every day at the Edinburgh Festival, are on sale. I heard from the legendary Joe Ruffles from the Rock and Roll Politics Cooperative. He's booked his tickets. And it will be a different show every day. I'll talk more about that on another occasion. But Andrew says, excellent podcast. Oh, thank you. And I enjoyed the Blair one. Oh, yeah, for Patreon subscribers, there's a bonus podcast at the moment, an interview I did with Tony Blair in 1996, summer of 96, months before the 97 election, where I compare him, what he was doing, with what Keir Starmer is doing. That's on the Patreon version. And there will be more to come up for Patreon subscribers in April, which is looming. Anyway, Andrew listened to it whilst walking around the meadows in Edinburgh. I didn't follow your advice and listen to Rachel Reeves' May's lecture, but I was depressed to read all the Thatcherite praise being briefed. It seems like Keir Starmer's team care nothing that Thatcher worship plays badly in Scotland, all parts of England and Wales too. Yeah, well, kind of amen to all of that, Andrew. You're walking in the meadows, I envy, but you should be running. A lot of people listen to this podcast while running, Andrew. You can run the meadows, perhaps Arthur's Seat, if you're really ambitious. But you're right. Well, I've said it already in my reflections. The winners don't reference back in awe. You reference back to make sense of what you're doing for the future. But you don't brief that you're sort of following a figure of the right who you need to challenge. And we are, in many ways, now facing the consequences of the 80s in, you know, the insecure energy provision, the sewage in the seas and the rivers, and all these things arose from some of the things that went on, the housing shortage. And if you praise the architect of all of that, you lose the space to analyse what went wrong, particularly in Scotland. It's an issue, as you say. And Andrew says, how seriously interested is Keir Starmer in Scotland? I can tell you, Andrew, very. They want those seats. And Keir Starmer wrote a brilliant column or article in, I think it was the Scotsman, when he was up campaigning in the by-election in late August, early September. And that was really good. And he wants it. But I think, you know, what happens with these briefings, some of them think, oh, yeah, this is what Tony and Gordon did when they were winning to appeal to Tories, praise Thatcher. Do you remember when Gordon Brown, early on in his premiership, invited Margaret Thatcher around to tea when lots of people in the Tory party thought David Cameron was a sort of dangerous lefty? It was all topsy-turvy politics, and it never works in the end. There are more risks than upsides now to all of that shallow nonsense. Enjoy the meadows, Andrew. I hope to see you at the Edinburgh Festival. Owen Jarvis writes, I had a debate in the pub with a friend last night, both Labour supporters. The questions we came to was, which of the Tory PMs of the last 14 years will be judged most harshly by historians for the mess we're in now? My friend pointed the finger at Johnson for damage to credibility of the office and scandalous behaviour. I, however, pointed the finger at Cameron plus Osborne for the unnecessary misjudged austerity. Where do you and the cooperative stand, and what criteria should we use to judge them? Interesting questions. I've got no doubt even Tory historians will look back at the series of prime ministers since 2010 and despair and analyse why it was that this Tory party that produced Macmillan and Rab Butler, not as a prime minister but close to, and others, Churchill, even Heath, although, of course, Heath is now dismissed unfairly in some respects as a disaster, produced a series of prime ministers not up to the job. I've always focused more on those errors of Cameron and Osborne because they weren't as spectacular as those of Johnson and Truss. And I've made reference to one that Rachel Reeves did in her lecture, the failure to borrow for investing in capital spending in 2010. And of course, the referendum, which Cameron held. He didn't hold it casually, but he did think he was going to win it. You don't hold referendums if you don't think you're going to win. You don't just offer them on the assumption you might lose. And it's interesting, Polly Toynbee and David Walker have got a book out quite soon analysing this whole 14-year period in terms of policy. And I think they place Cameron and Osborne as the most culpable of the, how many have we had now? 4, 5, 25 prime ministers. Thank you, Owen. Good discussion point. The cooperative will no doubt respond with thoughts. On now to Francis Lawler. I listen to your podcast driving home from work every Thursday evening from Surrey to Nottinghamshire. All right. So you kind of commute down and then spend some time down. Yeah. I like to know your lives. I live them all vicariously. Your point about character and how to lead and govern in whatever context you find yourself in is a crucial point in voting intentions at the next election. It's not just about the plan, it's about principles and values and how a government makes decisions. My question is, Starmer, Daniel Finkelstein, Anthony Seldon and others have spoken, written or reported on a change in the cabinet structure and how we govern, such as a smaller cabinet, a streamlined number 10 unit, a splitting of the cabinet secretary duties, giving the prime minister more of a strategic outlook and direction. Is this not overdue? It needs modernising. How can a prime minister know every action in every department and so on? Yeah, well, you've been thinking heavily while you've been driving, Francis. There is something wrong at the moment about how Britain is governed. Well, there's loads of things wrong about how Britain is governed. As you know, my main obsession is a lack of clear lines of accountability in the delivery of public services, from rail, which is just insanely fractured, to the National Health Service, and indeed, actually, the BBC. But within number 10, it is ridiculous. And you cannot micromanage departments. You can't have a proper discussion in a big cabinet, which meets once a week. Although it has to be said that if you have big cabinet figures, you can have a grown-up debate. Sometimes those debates went on far too long in the 1970s under Callaghan, who allowed cabinet discussions to last for sometimes days. But they were big discussions with big figures. Anthony Crossland, Tony Benn, Michael Foot, Roy Jenkins, David Owen, you know, these were big, big figures. Dennis Healy, of course, as Chancellor. And there is talk of establishing a quad, which happened in the coalition era, where Cameron Osborne, Nick Clegg and Danny Alexander used to meet as a quad and take most of the decisions. What I think you need, frankly, we are in such a presidential culture with the focus on a prime minister so intense, you need a big prime minister's department. At the moment, you've got this huge, mighty treasury. And in number 10, a kind of tiny little department. When Jospin went to visit Blair, Jospin was the, I think, prime minister of France at the time. Blair showed him round number 10 and he introduced him to his economics advisor. And Jospin said, oh, that's very interesting, Prime Minister. Could I see the rest of your economics department? I'd be interested to discuss what they're up to. And Blair said, no, no, that's it. This is my economics advisor, one person against that mighty treasury. Now, I think there will be quite a lot of reconfiguring. Sue Gray, it was a smart appointment by Keir Starmer. She knows Whitehall and how it works. And I think there will be a reconfiguration. However, nothing beats clarity of purpose, clarity of mission, and a deep awareness of the policies required to meet those missions. And that's what Thatcher had in 79, of course. Some of us profoundly disagree with both the ideas and the policies, but that she had that sense of mission was what drove everything. And you need that too. Now, have that Labour got it with Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves, the key duo? We won't entirely know until they're in post. We can just analyse from a distance before then. Thank you very much, Francis. Stephen Townsley makes an interesting point. Is it 92 or 97 has been the question up until now. The advance of Reform UK in the most recent polls brings in a new contender, 1983. Now, this is good, but I tweeted about this, actually. In 1983, the SDP was the breakaway party, far more substantial than Reform UK. It had won by-elections, unlike Reform. The first pass of the post-electoral system meant that the SDP took votes in places from Labour that kept the Conservatives in power. Reform could have the same impact in the 24 election. I agree. I mean, you know, the SDP were 10,000 times more substantial than Reform. They were founded by four former Labour cabinet ministers, glittering figures who had deep personal followings, and then were joined by other Labour MPs. Reform have, you know, the kind of, they're still awaiting the news as to whether Nigel Farage will lead them. Most voters will not have heard of Richard Tice, the current leader. And they've had Lee Anderson defecting. And Lee Anderson is not Roy Jenkins, David Owen, Shirley Williams and Bill Rogers, the four who founded the SDP. But they are having the same impact electorally, according to the polls. And the polls are terrifying Tory MPs, because in some polls, in terms of percentage votes, they are breathing down the necks of the Tory party. And that's why Thatcher won her landslide in 83. It was not the Falklands. The Falklands of it gave Thatcher a kind of majestic self-confidence, the Falklands, but no more than that. It was the split in the alternative governing party. There are only two parties who can win to form a government in UK elections under first past the post, Tories or Labour. And when Labour suffered a formal schism in between 81 to the 83 election, they were never going to win. And Thatcher realised that. Her big moves were made after the SDP were formed. That's when, in September 81, she brought Norman Tebbit into the cabinet. She sacked the Wets, or moved them to Northern Ireland, in the case of Jim Pryor. It wasn't after the Falklands that she acquired a new self-confidence. It was when Labour split and she realised they would not win the next election. And the Reform Party is at the moment, anyway, having the same impact, and will do so more if Farage will join. Now, I think a clever Tory leader could destroy them. They are all over the place in terms of policy. But lacking a clever Tory leader, they are terrifying the Tories, Reform UK, and they could have that SDP effect to give Labour a landslide. They could. And so, anyway, look, I'm going to stop now, if that's okay with you. Brilliant questions from lots of people. Joel Rawlings, is it easier for the ruling party to cash in on any sporting successes this summer? You know, could the England win the Euros and all the rest of it? Harold Wilson used to say in the 1970s, have you noticed England only win the World Cup under a Labour government? Because, of course, in 66, England won the World Cup when Labour were in power. And it's thought that perhaps when England was knocked out of the World Cup in 1970, a short time before the 1970 election, well, that impacted on things. I don't think it makes any difference at all, Joel, but there are kind of mythologies around sport. There's some other brilliant questions. We're going to get to them. Great to hear from Yatsun please tell me how you pronounce that, who I know indirectly, and thrilled that you've been in contact about tail end Charlie prime ministers and the implications arising from them. We need to deal with this when I've got a bit more time. The losing prime ministers from that tail end phase: Douglas Home, Callaghan, Gordon Brown. And what are the implications arising from them? Another podcast soon on that one. And thank you so much for saying that your two daughters, who are age 14 and 12, listen or come to Rock and Roll Politics. Yeah. Well, hope to see you all very soon. But I'll address the themes, if that's all right with you, on another. There are so many brilliant questions here. We're either going to have to do a bonus question time episode, or what I'm going to do is make a note of where I've got up to and come back to them next week if we don't have time for a bonus. Anyway, that's it for now. Let's get together again very soon. I don't know if any of you have stopped work yet, but if you have, enjoy the Easter recess. It's, politics. I mean, it's going to be building up to the May local elections, a pivotal moment in this pre-election frenzy. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks for your brilliant questions. Do keep them coming. The address, you should all have finished running or baking or cooking now, so you've got time to get a pen and say it's steverick14@icloud.com, and I say do keep them coming. And yeah, if you like it, please leave a review. Only if you like it a lot, 5 stars kind of thing. Everything else is a disaster. Please leave a review, that would be great, and do tell your friends to join our Rock and Roll Politics Cooperative. This is the podcast where we delve deep and therefore make sense of it all. Thanks so much. See you all soon. Bye.